from KQED.
From KQED Radio News, I'm Andrea Kissick with Quest, a weekly series exploring Northern California's science and environment. 37 years after the first Earth Day, a new study finds that people of color and low-income families continue to have higher rates of exposure to hazardous waste facilities and industrial polluters than the general population. But what does that mean for people's health? And what is being done to change this long-term pattern? This Earth Day, environmental justice advocates look at how far they've come and where they're headed. Amy Standen reports.
The Trejo family moved to the Bay Area a few years ago from Nogales, Mexico. They came looking for work and a better future for their son, Aaron, and later, Israel, who was born here in Richmond. The Trejos have both found jobs at a Mexican restaurant in San Rafael, but now Socorro Trejo says her biggest concern is the health of their two boys, who have asthma.
It gives me great despair, especially at night. I have to be very alert in case they start coughing. I have to give them the medicine, so I'm very tired.
Trejo believes that pollution in her environment is to blame for her children's sickness, but looking around, she's not sure where to point the finger. Within a mile of this modest subdivision are an oil refinery, a chemical plant, a Superfund site, a freeway, and several major truck routes. 20 years ago, a landmark study commissioned by the United Church of Christ found statistical basis for something many communities had suspected for years. African Americans, Latinos, and other minorities were much more likely to live near commercial hazardous waste facilities than non-minorities. Last year, the church commissioned an update to that report, and it's releasing the results this week. Robert Bullard is an environmental justice scholar at Clark Atlanta University and one of the authors of the report.
20 years later, we're finding that the problem has worsened. Over 56% of the residents who live within a two-mile radius of commercial hazardous waste facility are people of color. This is now. That's worse than it was 20 years ago.
But much has changed, and for the better. A strengthened Clean Air Act, tougher smog standards for cars and trucks, tougher rules on reporting toxic emissions. But while there may be less pollution overall, people of color still bear a disproportionate amount of the burden. That fact is what gave rise to the environmental justice movement, which started, many believe, 25 years ago in Warren County, North Carolina.
Rainbows on the ground.
We will not allow Warren County to become a dump site.
I'd like to live in peace and I'll go to jail in peace.
In 1982, there was a huge, huge civil disobedience demonstration where 500 people were arrested in Warren County, North Carolina, for opposing a PCB landfill site.
Sudeep Rao is the director of Literacy for Environmental Justice, a youth group in San Francisco. He says the Warren County protests marked the first time that residents rose up to complain that they were bearing an unfair burden of toxic pollution.
The fundamental thing that people gathered together was nobody deserves it, but fundamentally we don't deserve it. That community was already having a lot of polluting industries, and then this was the straw that broke the back of the camel.
Warren County protesters lost the fight against the landfill, but 1 year later, a report by the General Accounting Office found that Warren County was part of a pattern. Three of four toxic waste dumps in EPA's Region 4, which includes North Carolina, were located in predominantly minority neighborhoods. The Warren County protests inspired and set a model for grassroots environmental justice movements around the country. Again, Robert Bullard.
These were basically organizations that were run by moms and grandmothers. These were not organizations that had offices or had staffs or had payrolls. And so it was almost like a volunteer kind of thing.
That homespun quality distinguished environmental justice groups from much of the mainstream environmental movement, like the Sierra Club, Wilderness Society, and Greenpeace. Bradley Angel, who runs the San Francisco group Green Action, was an organizer for Greenpeace, but he left it in the 1980s.
I'm a big fan of saving the whales, and the mainstream environmental movement has done some pretty great things. What they've failed at, by and large, is understanding that real-life people were actually being the most polluted of anybody.
The fact that those real-life people are usually African-American or Latino presented a thorny question. Why were people of color so much more likely to live near toxic waste sites and other polluters? Some argue that this is a matter of economics. Low-income people are often also members of a minority group. But others blamed racial discrimination in the siting of these facilities.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
Kettleman City is a rural community in the Central Valley, near I-5. About 95% of its residents are Spanish-speaking. Yet, when officials proposed a toxic waste incinerator there, they only notified the community in English. Lawyers successfully argued that that move showed discrimination against Spanish speakers. Kettleman City residents won the case and kept out the incinerator. Of course, oftentimes, the pollution precedes the population. Here in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point, a low-income and largely minority community has gradually grown up around a cluster of industrial facilities. Residents live near a toxic old Navy shipyard, the city's largest sewage treatment plant, and a smattering of waste dumps. Until recently, they also shared the air with a heavily polluting 77-year-old power plant. In 2006, after a decade of protests, residents convinced the city and PG&E to shut down the power plant. Environmental justice advocates argued that the neighborhood already hosted more than its fair share of toxic chemicals. The fact that many people moved here after the polluters were already operating is beside the point, argues Juliet Ellis, director of the Oakland group Urban Habitat.
If folks were there and then the industry came there, it's a problem. And then if folks have no other choice and can't get anywhere else, that's also a problem because they have nowhere else to go. Nobody should be living in a place where they're getting sick. Nobody.
It's been shown that Bayview Hunters Point residents suffer higher rates of asthma, infant mortality, and certain cancers. But no one's been able to prove a link between many of those health problems and the pollution. Is cancer caused by living near a Superfund site or from smoking cigarettes, a poor diet, family genetics, or random chance? And that's the debate between the environmental justice advocates and many scientists. Again, Robert Bullard with Clark University.
Oftentimes, the science is not there to prove causality, the link between X chemical and Y disease. And so what the environmental justice movement has basically said is that we should flip this on its head. The burden of proof should not be on the victims. The burden of proof should be on the polluters to show that what they're doing is safe.
In the past, environmental justice campaigns have had to focus on what communities don't want. Garbage incinerators, landfills, power plants, and other industry. They're what Juliet Ellis with Urban Habitat calls reactive campaigns.
The reactive piece is an important piece. But the fact that we're in the same place, I think 20 years later, I think also speaks to kind of some of the strategies that we're doing aren't working.
Urban Habitat and other groups are taking a seat at the table when city governments talk about how to design communities, what cities like Richmond should look like 10 years from now.
For us, we talk about the environment as kind of where you live, work, and play. It includes transportation, it includes education, it includes land use, it includes housing. I think that it is a different definition of how you think about the environment.
Access to grocery stores and fresh produce, sidewalks, parks, healthcare, good schools, all of these, says Ellis, are environmental justice issues. For Quest, this is Amy Standen, KQED Radio News.
To learn more about environmental justice issues, you can visit our website, kqed.org/quest.
Major funding for Quest is provided by the National Science Foundation, the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and the Dirk and Charlene Capsanel Foundation.